Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. I apologize for the pause off the top there. I still had my mask on and I forgot to take it off. Today we are looking at the world of research and all of the various ways it touches our lives, as well as the process itself. You know, California is a massive research hub. You have the University of California, first of all, has the largest research library system in the nation. Plus, you have, of course, the incubators and entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley, and that's just to name some of the larger examples. But is there equity and inclusion within these large research systems? We'll speak with a Northern California woman who is taking on that issue. Also, smoke and ash from the fires this summer and now even into the fall have made it difficult to breathe at times. But what does it mean for the state's huge agricultural industry, specifically wine grapes this time around? Research scientists at UC Davis want to find out and are sampling Lodi grapes as a part of that project. And research of COVID-19 is likely the best path toward a post-pandemic world, which is an example of why the University of California wants to make its published research free and open to everyone. We'll speak with a top university librarian about the push to shake up the publishing world. But first, California bucked a national trend when it made stem cell research a constitutional right and provided funding for it at the same time. This as the Bush administration was placing federal restrictions on the science. Well, that money has essentially run out, and now state voters are being asked whether to continue this process with additional funding. Sammy Cayola is our healthcare reporter at Cap Radio, and she joins us now to help clear this up a little bit. Hey, Sammy.
Hi, Randall. Good morning.
Yeah, nice to have you with us this morning. You're great at explaining this kind of thing when it gets a little in the weeds and complicated. I love how you break it down into chunks we can understand. So let's start with how the funding worked for the 2004 stem cell initiative.
So what you referred to is Prop 71, which was a ballot measure that the voters approved back in 2004, and it essentially funneled $3 billion in state money to stem cell research. And as you referenced, it was difficult to get federal funding for this kind of research at the time because a lot of stem cell research comes from fetal tissue. It's called embryonic stem cell research. And it's the byproduct of when an embryo does not continue. So it's controversial. There are groups that oppose, mostly groups that oppose abortion. They oppose stem cell research. And so with that federal difficulty, California voters said, all right, well, we'll fund this on the state level. And so in 2004, Prop 71 passed $3 billion for stem cell research. And that all goes to the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, which is this big state research agency. And they actually give grants to scientists, UC scientists, nonprofit, clinics, anybody who says, hey, we have this idea, we do a proposal, it's stem cell based. And so CIRM is what I'll call it from here on in. And they're a granting agency. And over...
So CIRM doesn't do the research themselves. They fund the people that are doing
the
research.
Yeah, they largely fund research.
I see.
They largely give grants to scientists. Mm-hmm. And over the years, they've done... 90 clinical trials, a few thousand studies, and they've gotten actually two cancer treatments that are now FDA approved. And so they're basically saying, this has been a windfall. This has been great. We've been able to make California a leader in stem cell research. But now, as you said, the funding is running out. Mm-hmm. The Legislative Analyst's Office did an assessment, and they said that as of October 2019, there were only $132 million left in that pool. And actually, last July 2019, CIRM stopped taking applications for research. They told scientists, we're running out of money. Don't apply. We can't give you anything.
Right.
This is interesting. After the pandemic started, they did put out $5 million in grants for COVID-19 specifically.
I was going to ask if any of that has gone toward COVID-19. The money actually lasted longer than they thought, because I believe it was initially a 10-year plan. But that $3 billion... was serviced by bonds, right? So it actually, there's like an additional $3 billion.
Yeah, there's interest on top of that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Your question on COVID, the last decade or more, less 15 years, a lot of this research was around cancer and Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, a lot of these, you know, chronic conditions that we just have not had a cure or good treatments for. But yeah, after the pandemic, they said, okay, we definitely want to do something about COVID-19. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens with that 5 million. It's not a ton, but you know, it's been dispensed. And if the cure for COVID comes from CIRM, they're going to be really excited about it.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. So so we're down to 5 million out of initial $3 billion.
Well, we're down to about 132 million.
132.
That 5 is just for COVID.
That's right.
So looking toward the November ballot, what we've got is Prop 14, which asks for another $5.5 billion. It's also to be issued in bonds, and it would have a little bit more on top of it in interest.
Right.
And the opposition is we shouldn't go further into debt, right? We've got a housing crisis, we've got a pandemic, we've got education issues. Why spend this money on stem cell research?
It's a tough time right now.
It's a tough time right now. And a lot of the opposition will say, well, there's federal money. Right. Because a lot of those restrictions that I referenced earlier about embryonic research
from the Bush administration.
Yeah.
Period.
Obama repaired a lot of that. Mm. He came in and said, actually, no, this is great. This is OK. He lifted a lot of those restrictions. But in the Trump administration, we are starting to see some of them come back. Mm. So researchers in California are worried. They are worried that soon they're not going to have access to the National Institutes of Health, for example. So they're really asking for this state money. And when I talked to scientists last week, they referenced this concept called the Valley of Death, which I thought was interesting. Oh. So they say at the very beginning.
Sounds so biblical.
I know, it sounds frightening. Right? At the very beginning of research, when you're doing just the basic investigation, what is the biological process? Apparently it's easy at that point, or easy, right? There's a lot of red tape, there's a lot of paperwork, but you can usually get federal funding for that early part of the research. Mm. And then at the end, when you're in human clinical trials, you can get a lot of interest from private industry who wants to see, oh, is this going to become a drug? Can we market this? But there's this area in the middle that they call the Valley of Death, where you're mostly doing animal trials. And apparently that is where it's very hard to find funding. And that's where the state funding has been crucial. And so the worry is that if Prop 14 doesn't pass and these $5.5 billion are not allotted, that these projects that are in their early stages right now, that they might just die off and they might never make it through that Valley of Death and never become treatments that could theoretically be life-saving.
So progress that has been made on some of these different cures or what have you would end. Because they just can't make it past that point. The Valley of Death, as you call it.
Right. That is what the pro argument says, that if this proposition doesn't pass, this research will not happen. But you have other people that say, what are you talking about? There's tons of money in stem cell research. There's federal money. There's private money.
Yeah.
You'll be okay. Like they're basically saying, like, California researchers need to find other ways. The state can't keep stepping in.
So the opposition's main argument is that there are other sources of money.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And primarily that would come from private industry?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And federal money. But, you know, as I said, there could be new restrictions on that.
In this proposition, Prop 14, Sammy, are there any restrictions as to what can be studied using this research money?
Oh, that's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know all of the details around the requirements, but, you know, stem cell research does typically do really well with neurological diseases. It does do really well with cancer. So I expect we would see more of that kind of work. I know it's also been really huge for children with immune conditions, children who can't fight off diseases and get sick very easily. There's been some really momentous stem cell work in that area. So I would expect all of those areas are permitted.
Yeah. Do we know what would aside from this like Valley of Death thing, what would happen to the organization that was created? What was it again?
CIRM. Yeah, CIRM. The California Institute for Regenerative Medicine.
Would that just be shuttered?
That is a really interesting question, because they do only exist because Prop 71 passed.
Uh-huh.
So if Prop 14 doesn't pass, what does happen to them? That's a great question. I mean, they still have a little bit of money, so they may try to launch a few more projects, or they may try to shepherd their current projects a little further along. But ultimately, if they're a state-funded agency and there is no state funding, then they may, you know, go by the wayside. But that's a great question. I'd have to confirm with them what their kind of worst-case scenario is.
Yeah. And, you know, we were having a discussion in the newsroom a week or so ago when you were just getting started on reporting this. And, you know, people were saying they could see how you could fall on either side, you know, as a supporter of research, you know, absolutely. And then also, hey, the state is in a really bad spot right now. Do we have the ability to do this? Of course, when you bond things out, it's sort of a long picture sort of thing. So perhaps the pandemic gets under control, the state, you know, but that's hoping, you know, for a rosy picture down the road. So is there any sort of polling that, you know, a lot of times polling focuses on the big issues that are on the ballot? I haven't seen a lot of ads related to this. I don't know that it's a top prop in terms of controversy and such. So is there any information out there as to how Prop 14 is faring among voters?
Yeah, this prop has not gotten a ton of attention, I don't think. And I have not seen any polling. But there have been a couple of editorials that have opposed the measure in some major newspapers. I think the San Jose Mercury News opposed it. Mm-hmm. The Bakersfield Californian opposed it, I'm pretty sure. And with the argument that this is not a good time to be spending and to be taking on this amount of debt for something that is a long range solution. Like, yes, we do want to cure cancer, but is that what we need to worry about right now? It doesn't. Some people are saying it's not feasible. It's just not feasible right now. And we need to either put some of this research on pause or find other ways to fund it. We need to lean on private industry, or we need to lean on the federal government. And so, you know, they don't want to keep cushioning the research from the state coffers. And so, yeah, the editorials are probably the most public comment that I have seen on it. There may be polling, though.
Yeah, I haven't really seen a lot. Sammy Caola is our healthcare reporter here at Cap Radio, helping us wrap our brains around Prop 14. Thank you, Sammy. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Randall.
Up next, new research is planned to figure out how the state's wine crop has been affected by wildfire smoke and ash, of which there's been a lot. We'll speak with a UC Davis scientist about it and the struggle for underrepresented researchers of color and how that can affect all aspects of research, including what is funded and then studied. A reminder that at any point during the show or during the day, for that matter, you can reach out to us via Twitter with the Ask Insight hashtag. I'm Randall White. This is Insight, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our focus today is the world of research and the variety of ways it touches our lives as well as the process itself. California, Oregon, and Washington have been burning up this summer and now into the fall. All three are large wine-producing states, with California topping that list. The massive record-setting wildfires have produced record-breaking smoke and ash, which have enveloped the vineyards right at a time when many of the varietals are ready for harvest. What does this mean for some of the most sought-after and expensive wine grapes in the world? Dr. Anita Oberholster is a cooperative extension specialist in viticulture and enology at UC Davis, and she joins us now to talk about her push to study the effects of that smoke and ash. And great to have you with us this morning, Doctor.
Thank you. It's great to be with you this morning.
Yeah, so we had massive fires in wine country in recent years. I'm thinking about the Tubbs fire 3 years ago, but there, of course, have been others. Did we learn anything from that experience about smoke exposure and grape quality?
Yes, we did. But unfortunately, we're at that phase in research where we're learning everything we don't know rather than answers to the questions that we have. So the list of questions are growing, but at least we're a little bit better prepared. It's just it's such a huge fire. It really burned so much vegetation. It's impacting a much larger portion of the wine regions than before. Yeah. And nobody was prepared for just the extent of the fires and the extent of the smoke. And obviously this year, unfortunately, it was right at the beginning of harvest. Previously, it was more at the end of harvest, so most of the grapes were already harvested. That makes the impact on the wine industry potentially, and grape industry potentially, much larger.
And just the air quality itself, it was so day after day after day. I remember the smoke from the Tubbs fire, that whole complex of fires that were burning in the North Bay. It was a few days, but then we got relief. This went on for weeks, and I imagine that has an effect as well.
Yes, but something that I want the public to remember is there is actually not a direct relationship between air quality and smoke exposure risk to grape wine quality. Yes. So what you see is actually mostly carbon. And the compounds that can impact grape wine quality, and this is not a health concern, it's just, you know, it absorbs onto grapes and it can make it taste smoky, ashy. And most of us don't want that in our wine. It's really not a direct relationship because these compounds are small. You can't see them with the naked eye. They degrade in the open air. They oxidize. So where ash is very stable, it's mostly carbon. So there's the closest relationship between smoke exposure risk when the smoke is really, really fresh, like that first day. So it all really depends on where the vineyard was, where the fire was, what was the wind direction, how quickly did you get that smoke. The longer it just lingers around, the less of a risk it becomes.
Some grapes, if I have this right, doctor, produce similar compounds that are found in smoke. So are you able to tell through testing whether those compounds were created naturally by the grape or they came from an outside source like a wildfire?
So that's a great question. So yes, these compounds are naturally in grapes. So both the free and bound forms. So really, this is a matter of too much of a good thing is not a good thing anymore. So at low levels, it adds to the complexity of a wine. At high levels, it becomes, you know, it just becomes one-dimensional and overpowering. So no, this is actually exactly the same compound. So we can't distinguish what came from a fire, what actually was naturally in the grape. And this is what we are trying to address now. What we need to do is for all the different wine regions, we need to go and determine for their main grape varieties, what's natural. What is the level that is natural so that we can know when there is a smoke event, what is elevated. And then we need to determine what's the thresholds in that specific grape variety and that wine matrix that makes it unacceptable so that we can help grape growers know what that number means. They send it to a lab. What does it mean? Are you impacted or not? Because just because they get a number back that says they have these compounds doesn't actually mean that much because they're naturally there. And then they keep asking me, what's too much? And it's really, really difficult to answer because a lot of it falls into this gray area of maybe it's natural, maybe it's not. When it's excessive, then it's easy to give them an answer. But it's this gray area that's really, really complex.
Because I've had wines that taste smoky, and it's even on the label sometimes, you know, telling you that it has this smoky tobacco flavor or what have you. And so it's just right, the how much is too much and when it becomes overpowering, I guess.
Yeah, so that smokiness, many times when you see that actually comes from oak barrels.
Oh,
You know, so a lot of expensive wine and a lot of wine. People, you know, especially the U.S. market really likes oak. Now, if you toast an oak barrel, you get exactly the same thing happening. you have some volatile phenols. These are the compounds we're talking about, forming as you toast that oak, the wood. So you give more of those compounds into the wine. But at that levels, it gives you spiciness, toastiness, slight smokiness. It's seen as a positive. It's adding complexity and layers to your wine. Aroma, you know, profile. It's really when it's excessive. What I see really distinctive of what we call smoke taint is you get this retronasal. So when you actually put the wine in your mouth, you get this ashiness in the back of your throat. So I don't see smokiness on the nose as an indicator of smoke taint. It's really that very distinctive ashiness at the back of your throat that for me is a negative. And it's something I've never seen in a barrel-aged wine, or naturally. That's really, okay, I think here is a smoke impact.
So what you plan to do is take grapes from this harvest and compare them directly with grapes from the same vineyard in an earlier harvest. And I know that you've reached out to Lodi to get some grapes there, and you're working with a researcher up in Oregon for some grapes there. Anywhere else you're sourcing from?
Yeah, so we're actually the West Coast, you know, we're all impacted at this point in time. So I'm actually working with Elizabeth Tomasino. She's a professor at Oregon State University. And I'm working with Thomas Collins. He's a professor at Washington State University. And we're working together to really just, we're just soliciting grapes from everywhere. We have walk-in freezers. We're trying to get as much samples as we can. And the idea would be to go back next year, fingers crossed, and they gained grapes from the same vineyards that aren't smoke impacted. And we're trying to, we want to analyze all these grapes and link this to atmospheric data. Because this is the problem. Everybody wants to know, am I impacted or am I not? And now everybody is sending samples to labs to get a number, which isn't always as informative as you would like it to be. And the labs are overrun. They just don't have the capacity for the number of samples they're getting. And it's really expensive. This is advanced techniques. This is not everybody that can do this. So that is the problem. If we could just get some kind of sensor or by atmospheric tracking, tell which vineyards are more, would potentially be more impacted than others, then we can at least say, okay, you have to be testing just to make sure, but this region, you don't have to be concerned. At this point in time, we have to say, look, if you had smoke in your vineyard, maybe, maybe not. You know, we know it's only fresh smoke is the most risk, but any smoke could potentially be a risk. We don't know for sure. And for any kind of crop insurance, you really do need a number. You need to test. And that's another layer of burden on the grower.
And it's critical right now for the growers because this is when they would be selling the grapes, right? And so the buyers might be, I don't know, you were near that wildfire, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's a lot of perception. It's really, really difficult because we just know, and that's the other thing. We need to work on our testing methods. We need to get, if we can get something simpler and faster, that is just more predictive, it would be great. Because at this point in time, the grape grower sits with maybe, maybe not. The buyer of that grapes that want to make wine is like maybe, maybe not. Everybody is like really making decisions, only having a small part of the puzzle.
Yeah.
You're not really making a 100% informed decision. It's really, it's very difficult. It's a very difficult situation. It's very frustrating for everybody.
Yeah. And Doctor, you're at the funding stage right now?
Yeah. So me and my colleagues, we are collecting all these grapes, but we're actually still writing the grant to analyze all those grapes. This is what happens when there's a new massive concern in the industry. Sometimes you're doing the research before you have the funding.
All right.
Very positive about it. And yes, you know, it is a difficult year to obtain funding, but we're very hopeful because it's obvious that, you know, since 2017, we've basically almost every year, some region have been impacted by fires.
Yeah.
real concern. We really need to get a better handle on this. We need to be able to support our grape and wine industry better than we can at this moment, because we only have questions and questions and questions.
And it is a massive industry here in California. Dr. Anita Oberholzer is with UC Davis Viticulture and Enology. Thank you so much for joining us and giving us that insight into, you know, we're affected so much by the fires. There's even in down into these little areas like this right here. And I guess it's not really such a little area. Doctor, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for talking to me.
So the stem cell research we talked about with Sammy Kaola earlier and the wine research that we just heard about from Dr. Oberholzer are just two examples of California's massive research industry. It's a field that some say does not have proper diversity, equity, and inclusion when it comes to people of color. Christina Gomez is a doctoral candidate in the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley. She saw a need to address the issue, so she started a university-based organization called Underrepresented Researchers of Color. And Christina joins us now on Insight to walk us through why this is such an important issue to her and others. Christina, thank you.
Thank you.
So one of the big issues, I'm sure you heard about the funding in both of the last two segments. Funding is a big deal. And when it comes to researchers of color, they might have ideas for what should be studied, but then the funding's not there.
That's right. There's actually been evidence to show that the National Institutes for Health, for example, score Black applicants lower than white applicants, and oftentimes because of the topic that is being selected. Communities of color often prioritize studying disadvantaged unincorporated communities or disadvantaged communities across the country that they relate to, that they're from. And so this research tends to be around health disparities, but it may not be as sexy to a funder. And part of that problem is that the reviewers of these grant applications may not necessarily find the priority of researchers of color to be their priorities.
Mm. Yeah. So let's start with how you then got the money to fund your group. You got a grant for it, right?
Yes, yes. It was during my undergraduate experience. I was doing research and found myself to not be able to find a place on campus where I could really talk about this intersectionality of being a woman of color and being a researcher. I had to go do field experience in Washington, D.C., and really, like, where could I go on campus to get a resource? So along with a colleague, Nalia Rodriguez, who's now studying at UCI, we saw this need to both demystify research for students of color, but also create support. So we applied for an innovation grant from UC Berkeley's Initiative for Inclusion, Equity, and Diversity. Mm-hmm. We established it through the Office of Undergraduate Research, and we started it in 2015.
And it was important for you to make this university-based and not simply a student group. Can you explain the difference?
Yes, oftentimes I think as a student, we want to have agency and we want to be able to determine how an organization is like, and we might choose a student org route. But we wanted it to be university based because we felt like it was important to hold the universities accountable for the research outcomes of students. Mm. This year at the UCs, it's the largest Latinx community that's coming in, incoming students. That's great.
Throughout the UCs. Wow.
Uh-huh. But it's like oftentimes like come and to this research university, come and do research. We invite you to our sandbox to play. But sometimes we don't tell people about the glass that there might be in the sandbox, the obstacles. And so we wanted students to have resources on knowing that they can do research. So we wanted to hold the university accountable for how many students are actually doing research on campus that are students of color. How's their experience? Are you holding faculty accountable in maybe their tenure packages for making sure that they're supporting students of color along this research path?
Yeah. Christina, it might seem like an obvious question, but I think you and your experience can really help us understand it better than what might come to top of mind. Why is it important to have underrepresented students of color engaging in research?
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned earlier, that for many of us who are researchers of color, you know, we see our lived experience. You know, it's our lived experience or our work experience, and we see the issues, the problems that are happening in our communities, how policies impact our communities. We also see the beautiful resilience and ingenuity that may not always be captured in research, and sometimes it's too deficit-based. And so by having a diversity of researchers and diversity of thought, you're getting multiple perspectives that may be missed. So I have part of a Robert Wood Johnson's Health Policy Research Scholars fellow, and I have colleagues that are studying Black urban farmers who use farming as a form of resistance. Another colleague at Boston University.
We have that right here in Sacramento. There's some of that farming going on. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's amazing, and it's important. Similarly, at UC Davis, another scholar starting to look at indigenous populations and the way that they do fire stewardship. This is essential to California right now. Another colleague at Boston University that's studying as a neuroscientist that's looking at the Alzheimer gap between Black and white populations. And someone else in Arizona who's looking at the way that transportation planning excludes communities. Mm. So I feel as though we are everywhere in the United States. Why not use and leverage the experiences and the understanding that students of color bring that can diversify our research and really create innovations across different fields.
Yeah. Christina, how long has your group been established now?
It's been around for 5 years.
Five years?
And yes.
Have you been able to measure or judge a difference that it's made?
This is something we are wanting to do. The data is hard to collect.
Right.
And I think this is something that we are asking the university to do, is how can we measure? We currently don't even know how many students are doing research on campus and how many students of color are doing it. So we need to find a metric to be able to measure that.
Mm-hmm.
But we at least have the anecdotal stories, right? The stories of people who are going on and now are in graduate programs. And this is such an important part of the pipeline. You need to do research as an undergrad to leverage that experience to be able to get into graduate school, so you can leverage that experience to become a faculty, so that you can diversify the research knowledge base and future generations.
What would you say are some of the really the top things that universities and research funders can be doing now to support underrepresented researchers of color on the various campuses?
Thank you. One is time.
Time?
Give students time. Mm-hmm. Give students the time in campus to be able to do research that's rigorous. Our university professors incentivized to provide students with their time, giving them research opportunities,
mm-hmm.
Spending time actually meeting with them. There was a study, I think it was by Milkman in 2012, the Wharton School, that showed that there's even bias at this very entry level, where they did an experiment where they sent emails out and all they did was change the name or the gender of recipients, and found overwhelmingly that there was even bias in who got a positive response, even though it was the exact same email.
So some of the names were clearly, or seemed to be clearly white names, and others were, you know, various races. And the professors were more willing to write back to the students that had the white names?
Correct.
Yeah.
And especially if it was a white male.
Uh-huh.
So the gender made a difference. And
wow.
So if schools can hold faculty accountable for those opportunities, make sure that students can get in the door and actually get that research experience.
Well, Cristina Gomez is Cristina Gomez Vidal, right?
Yes.
A doctoral candidate in the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley. We really appreciate you taking time to share your experiences with us on this important topic today.
Thank you so much.
Still ahead, the role of a university library in supporting research and how the University of California wants to shake up, really, the publishing world with free open access to research. You're listening to Insight right here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And just a quick reminder, the Insight team here, we love to hear from you. It helps inform our future guests, questions we might ask our current guests. And there's a couple of easy ways you can do it. You can reach out to us via Twitter with the hashtag AskInsight. You can contact me directly. I'm at Randall White. That's with an O-L, a little unusual spelling there. And the show is at CAP Radio Insight. You can also email us by using insight@capradio.org. So if you've hesitated in the past, don't send us a note. We'd love to hear what you think about the different guests we have on and your thoughts on the topics. Our big conversation today has been focused on research and the many ways it touches our lives. In the context of COVID-19, scientific research is most likely the ticket out of this crisis. Some say the most effective way to do this is to have researchers sharing what they're learning quickly and easily with each other, but also with doctors and other public health professionals and with policymakers. And you might be one of those, but with you, the public as well. With our next guest, we're going to talk about how the University of California is working to share its research as a public university with the world. Mackenzie Smith is the university librarian and vice provost of digital scholarships at UC Davis, and she joins us now to help us understand how this might work. Good to speak with you again, Mackenzie.
Good morning, Randall. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So as the university librarian at UC Davis, can you start by telling us about the role, just to kind of get an idea of how all this works, the role a university library plays in supporting research?
Of course. That's a great question. Well, as you know, knowledge builds up over time, and scientific research builds on prior research to make new discoveries. Mm-hmm. And libraries are really the engine of that research. We provide the fuel, which is access to all the prior research results and to recorded knowledge so that researchers today can build on that to make their new discoveries. And we also help researchers share their results with each other and with the public. So our job is to really limit the friction in the engine so that it is as fast and efficient as possible.
Yeah. At one point when I was talking to you about this, not on air, I asked you, or I gave a comparison. I said, so would if researchers were like the cooks, would the research library be the grocery store? And you said, yes, but it would also be the seed farm. It would be the ag industry. It would be the distribution channels. It's everything that has to do with that meal that was cooked.
Right. Right. You mm-hmm. know, the fuel comes from everywhere. Raw materials like seeds in a seed bank, organic produce from a farmer's market or the grocery store analogy. But basically, you can't do research without access to the knowledge that's already out there.
So the University of California has been in the headlines quite a bit. Some people might have missed it because it's not one of those top headline things, but it has been there have been stories written about this over the past year or so related to open access publishing. And this includes some high profile negotiations the university has had with Elsevier. They're the publisher of The Lancet and currently the world's top publisher of research. For the past year or so, the university has not had an ongoing contract with them. Can you help explain how that came to be?
I can, but I think first I might need to explain what open access is briefly.
Yeah.
And why we're even having this conversation.
Right.
So I'll just say that traditionally, the way that researchers got access to scientific knowledge through journals was through quite expensive subscriptions, which the library would pay. And that over time, that's caused more and more friction in the engine. It's preventing research universities from, like UC, from getting our research out to the world, to the public, and to other researchers who need it. So we decided, along with the vast number of researchers at the university, that we needed to change that model and make the research freely available to read so that anyone can get access to it for free to learn what those discoveries are and how it can help them. And to pay for the publishing costs, then there's a small publication fee that you pay so that, the wheels still turn, but the way it's paid for is different and much more equitable.
So the UC system wants to pay sort of a bulk fee off the top, and then anyone who wants to look up what you've done can find it and download it and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the devil's in the details about who pays what, when, but
right.
Yeah, basically, you pay up front.
But Elsevier doesn't work on that system. They work on the system where people who are looking up research then have to pay per article.
That's right. Well, they have traditional subscriptions to their journals. They do have other open access journals, mm-hmm. but most of their journals, like The Lancet you mentioned, are traditional subscription models. So very few... decreasing number of researchers actually have access to that.
And when you asked Elsevier to, and I say you as the University of California, asked Elsevier to flip that model, you guys could not come to an agreement. And so the UC system did not re-up the contract that they had with the publisher.
That's exactly what happened. Our contract expired. We tried to negotiate a new one, couldn't come to terms. That was almost 2 years ago now. So we've just been living without access to their journals since then, while we negotiated with other publishers, most recently Springer Nature, who published the Nature journals, which are also very famous.
And the journal Nature, right?
And the journal Nature, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, and those negotiations have gone extremely well. So we do have contracts with other publishers that are exactly what UC was looking for.
Mm-hmm. And Springer Nature is number two in the publishing world for research.
Right. And I should say that these aren't qualitative differences. They're volume. So Elsevier is the largest commercial publisher in the world. They publish thousands of journals, some mm-hmm. great, some not great. It's a mix. Springer Nature is the second largest. And then there's a lot of others, including small scholarly societies and nonprofit publishers.
And
but Elsevier is the big one.
And it's important to have a relationship with the largest distributor of research information because, for one, they're respected, right? The journal Lancet has been around for centuries, I believe, a pretty long time. And so the research community relies on these publications that they've gone to time and time again. And all of a sudden, they're not seeing UC Davis, or I should say the University of California research showing up there. Have you heard from researchers around the world, hey, where's your stuff?
Yeah. So I'll correct a slight misunderstanding there, which is that our authors are still publishing their research with Elsevier journals and in any other journal that they choose to. What's changed is that our researchers don't have access to other people's research in those journals, except through other means that the library provides, which is not as efficient. So our research is still getting out there, but we are determined as a university to change this model so that it's freely available.
I see.
And we don't want researchers to have to pay to get it.
So by not having the relationship with Elsevier, it hurts the researchers on the UC end and the students because they can't access previous studies or current studies that may have been done on the very topic that they're looking into.
Yes, and that was our fear, is that it would hurt the faculty and students. What we've discovered is that we are able to get access to those articles through the library. It's just not as efficient. So back to my point about our job being to make the system as fluid and efficient as fast as possible, that's why we need a new contract with Elsevier.
Yeah, there's a lot of workarounds, but they eat up that one valuable thing that even the wealthiest of us can't get more of, time, right?
That's right.
And when we're up against a time clock like COVID-19, I imagine that's critical.
Yes, it is. The pace of research has escalated. You heard that from Professor Oberholster, too, with the fires. The need to conduct research on timely topics has never been greater, and it's global. You know, it's the fires we have in the U.S. are terrible, but they've also had a lot of fires in Australia. So there's a lot of research going on there that we need to look at. And with the pandemic, of course, research is happening all over the world. So this is really proving our point that you need free, unfettered access to research to solve these global problems.
So, Mackenzie, your argument, and again, I mean the UC's argument regarding open access has been accepted by several of the larger publishers, including Springer Nature. How has that changed the tune for the people at Elsevier? We are just about to start a new academic year for the UC system. So might students in this fall quarter or semester, I guess it's all quarters with the UC, how might they be able to access some of the research moving forward?
Well, I'm happy to report that the university is back in negotiations with Elsevier. That just started quite recently. And you know, we're seeing signs that things have changed. The pandemic wasn't a thing when we were last talking to Elsevier, and you know, they too understand how important access to research in a timely way is now. So we're back at the table with them, and the fact that we were able to get successful contracts with some of their biggest competitors, I think, is also telling. So we are cautiously hopeful that we'll have some kind of a contract with them. And in the meantime, we can get to the research. It's just less easy.
Mm-hmm. How quickly might something like this move along? They're based in the Netherlands?
That's right.
Yeah. How quickly could the negotiations take place?
That's a really good question. I mean, it could go as quickly as a month or two, or it could drag on, you know, the rest of the year. It's really impossible to predict right now, but we are trying to move it along as quickly as we can.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, how have you seen concrete examples of not having that relationship, or that, I guess relationship is an okay word, slow down important research?
Not really. It's, because the libraries at all of the UC campuses have been killing themselves to make this easier for researchers, we've put a lot of measures in place to help get access to that research through other means. But it's kind of like taking your medicine. You have to allow a time when things aren't as efficient as they should be to get to the greater good of free, unfettered access. So it's very tempting, I think, for a lot of libraries to say, oh, this hurts too much. We'll just go back to the old way of doing things. And if people can't get access to the research, oh, too bad, you know. Mm-hmm. But we at UC, and I really have to give the credit to the faculty here, they have been very committed to the greater outcome of open access. So we're taking our medicine, but we're hoping that we won't have too much longer.
And Mackenzie, we should point out that if you are a researcher, you publish in one place. It's not like you can publish the same research through several different publications. So if it is on one of the many publications owned by Elsevier, you're not going to be able to find it at Springer Nature.
Right. Researchers publish their results in one journal, typically. They might post a version of that article on their website or something like that, but the formal official publication is in one journal only. So they always look for the journal that will have the most impact. has the greatest readership and the best reputation in their field.
Mm-hmm. Could the University of California, as big as it is, start its own research publishing operation?
Yeah, sure, it could. In fact, we have a University of California press that's world famous in areas that it publishes in, but there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of disciplines that people do research in.
Right.
So there are established journals in all of those fields. And what we probably can't do, at least in my opinion, is ask UC faculty to publish in a journal other than the one that they prefer, just because the university
runs. That makes sense. Yeah. Mackenzie Smith is a university librarian and vice provost of digital scholarship at UC Davis. I should say the university librarian. We really appreciate you taking the time to help us understand. It's a pretty complex topic, but I think you did an excellent job of breaking it down.
Thank you, Randall. I appreciate that.
All right. And you can find out more about any of our guests or the topics that we discussed here today on Insight at capradio.org/insight. That's the show for today. I'm Randall White with producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Technical director Mark Jones. Engineer is Antonio Munez. Insight's managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Joe Barr is the top guy. Thanks again for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.